So, good morning, and welcome to Thanksgiving in the Park. My name is Arlene. I'm a compulsive overeater. Will those who wish to, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Are there any other compulsive eaters here beside myself? Yay. Isn't it so beautiful? Thank you to my team. Write your gratitude on the table. The following is the OA preamble. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. We welcome everyone who wants to stop eating compulsively. There are no dues or fees for members. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, neither soliciting nor accepting outside donations. OA is not affiliated with any public or private organization, political movement, ideology, or religious doctrine. We take no position on outside issues. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive overeating and to carry this message of recovery to those who still suffer. I have asked Alexis, are you still here? Hello? She did all the work and left. Okay. Then I ask Cindy to please come up and read how it works from the big book. You don't have your reading glasses. Okay. Who else was my helper today? And I would like you to come up. Kathy, to read how it works.
Wait, I have to read all this.
No, you don't have to do it at all.
No, I'll do it. All this? Really? Okay. Okay, I'm just doing it. Hi, Kathy, compulsive overeater. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. The who's who do not recover are people who not, oh, who cannot, I'm sensing I shouldn't, like, my thighs look fat. Okay. We're not completely giving themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Oh my God, I keep looking at that. Can I just quit? Yeah. No, I'll do it. No, I'm going to do it. There is such unfortunate. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. They are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with food, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without a help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, one that is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number one, no, let's all do it together. We admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for His knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything with perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along a spiritual line. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection, rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the overeater, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our overeating. And C, that God could and would if He were sought.
Okay. In honor of the Thanksgiving holiday, we're reminded of the many gifts this program has given us. Please write them on your tables. The following speakers will be sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us today. Each speaker speaks for 20 minutes. Garrett is the timer. You could let him know how you'd like your time. And our first speaker today is Erica. Woo!
Can I stand? You can do whatever you want. I have to be different and stand.
No.
Hi, everybody. I'm Erica, compulsive reader. I have pictures, so.
How would you like to invite the
This is wonderful. I have never been to Thanksgiving in the park, so yes, I'm from over the hill, whatever that was. And I'm grateful to be here. To qualify, I have 11 years of abstinence out of relapse, and I'm maintaining over 100 pounds of weight loss with God's help. So here we go. First of all, I have to start off by saying this is my big event for the day. I am not a fan of Thanksgiving at all. For me, it was a painful holiday. I was trying not to eat on Thanksgiving most of the time, and then I'd be thrown in with a bunch of strangers I didn't know, forced to make small talk, and to me it was hell on earth. And of course I ate when I got home, and then I ate some more and ate some more and ate some more. And as a 100-pounder, you know, my best attempts did not get me, it just got me bigger, really. And I have a long story, and I was telling Ori before I started, like, I don't want to bore myself because I've heard it a lot, so I'll try to make it, I don't know, God will just tell me what to say. But As I said, I have relapsed. I have relapsed twice. I first came into OA in 1991 when I was 19. I was at my physical bottom where I finally figured out that I was big. Like, I kind of knew I was, but I never really checked myself out. And I just lost it. I could not believe that I was 250 pounds. And I was going out in public to an event, and my ego was so big that I thought everybody would be looking at me in particular, and it was just devastating. And thank God at the time my mom had been going to OA, and she never pushed me. She never said, you should go with me. But it got me to a point where I was like, there is some place called Overeaters Anonymous. I can see it's helping my mom. I'm going to go. So I went. I stayed for 5 years, and I don't know if I necessarily half measured it, but my program life was very small. Actually, I came in as an agnostic, so I did come to believe in a higher power during that time. But I also made my sponsor my higher power. I had 2 meetings that I went to a week, and when things didn't go my way, I just, you know, principles before personalities, I was like, screw everybody, and I'm leaving, and the food got bigger, and I was still taking candles, and I finally left, and then I came back in 2002, and I knew, at that point, I was, I guess that was my emotional bottom. I was withdrawing from being hooked to, it was in another program, but love addiction. And the pain was so excruciating for me, and I was eating like there was no tomorrow. I put on 10 pounds in a week, and there was no end in sight. And I'm not somebody that uses drugs because I really do like to be in control. And I feel like if I'm using drugs, I'm not in control. But I was tempted to be locked away somewhere or to go on to do some type of drug that would make me not feel the pain I was feeling. And my lover, my best friend, food, was no longer working, which was absolutely incredibly frightening for me. So I came back, not necessarily on my knees, because once again, the ego was very big. And I worked the steps. I followed direction. I'm very good at that. I'm the good student. And I became abstinent, and I got close to a healthy body weight, and I had 3 years of abstinence, and then things got shaky because I took back my will. I took back my will with my weight, and I said, this is not good enough, God. For me, my higher power is God, but that's not the case for everybody, of course. And I decided suddenly I could control my food and my weight, and the weight I was at was just not enough. And so I was going to suddenly have control, and I was going to muscle this thing into, you know, muscle my disease, which, by the way, has kicked my ass and then some. It was not a pretty picture, and me in relapse, thank God, I always say, I had my previous sponsor used to say this. For her, it was bullshit that I say this, but for me, that I never left the rooms, it was a wonderful thing. Because had I left the rooms, I think I would have gained even more weight. I would have been even more miserable. But boy, was it humbling to be going to meetings and gaining weight and eating before meetings and eating after meetings. And just in that space of, once I figured out I was no longer abstinent, it was a matter of, man, I'm in hell and I don't know how to get out. And so when I'm eating, I am really resentful, and I'm overly sensitive as it is, but when I'm eating, it's multiplied. So I'm sitting in meetings and I'm stewing. I'm like, well, I do everything that person does, and I do this and I do that. Why am I still eating? And I hate all these people. And at the same time, I cried a lot, and I was raw, and it was super painful, and I always like to remember and recall for myself. I just know the people that I look to in recovery that have the time ahead of me, they don't forget where they came from. They don't forget how painful and humiliating it is to eat. And so stories like I was sitting in my bed, and I was surrounded by food, and I knew that if I ate one more time, I wouldn't be able to wear any clothes to work the next day. Like, I had down to one pair of pants that I could fit in, and it was close to the borderline, and I ate anyway, and I ate, and I ate, and I ate, and I woke up the next day, and I can't remember, I called in sick or found some skirt with some really big elastic, but I went from 150 pounds to 220 pounds in the matter of 7 months. And I didn't care. And I I got out of that relapse by really clawing my way back. I really wanted what you guys had. I wanted what the people had with that shining light in their eyes that they just looked like they were excited to get up that day and not like, oh, God, kill me now, please. And that's how I felt. I felt like I was beyond depression. It was, I've always been somebody that's too chicken to kill myself. But I felt like I was just enveloped in this darkness, not to be dramatic, but that's really how it felt. And so much was involved in getting out of my relapse, but I'd like to share about it because there's people, and I know might be some of you, that are still in that space of food still calls your name and you still turn to the food and food is still the answer. And I was in that space where I felt like I couldn't exist without food. I couldn't exist without sugar and flour and being able to peruse the aisles at midnight for whatever I could, you know, whatever my dream binge foods were at that time. And I felt like I was 3 years old, like I want to get everything in that I was denied for 3 years. And at the same time, as I said, I cried a lot and I was raw and I hated my life and I couldn't hold a job when I'm eating. I can't hold a job. I don't leave the house unless it's to buy food. For some reason, I wasn't big into delivery. I don't know. I mean, if Grubhub was around, I don't know, maybe. But I like to go and, like, kind of be on the hunt. I don't know why I'm talking about that, but that's the way I was. And so getting out of the relapse was a matter of just really having that ego deflated, like Dr. Tybo, and I get Dr. Tybo and Dr. Silkworth confused and it comes of age, but it talks about having the ego reduced to the point where I'm willing to be open to what God's plan is for me. And I would write God letter after God letter, like, please, God, give me the willingness to stop eating today, to do whatever it takes to stop eating. And it took a while. It took a lot to break that. That my disease was so loud. And I always like to remind myself, and when people ask me, how'd you get out of it, I poured on so much program when I was willing to, in those moments I was willing to, that the diseased voice became just 49% less strong than the recovery voice. I needed that particular scale to tip so that I wasn't, it's almost like being an automaton, like I was just controlled by the sugar and the flour and my binge foods, and it was very, very all-encompassing. And thank God, you know, of course, I was talking to somebody else earlier, and it's like, when does God answer the prayers? And I believe they're always being answered, but sometimes it takes some time, and sometimes even I'm asking, and I'm not being genuine. I'm like, I'd like to stop eating, but yet, really, 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 I want to keep eating. So it just happened, I was at a meeting in the Valley, because that's where I'm from, and I was at a podium, and I was crying my eyes out, and they had a sign that was misspelled and incorrected, I have to tell you, and it said abstinence is the most important thing without exception, and I was just beside myself, because I wanted that back, and no matter what I did, I couldn't get it. I would get a day, I'd get a couple of days, I'd get a few weeks, and then I would eat again. And something shifted that night. I don't like to stand up in front of people, but most of my healing comes from that letting it go and having people be a witness to it, even beyond my sponsor in a lot of ways. And so after that night, I think it was either the next day or the day after, I became abstinent. And it wasn't just that one event. What led up to it was getting a new sponsor. I asked everybody I could think of that I respected to be my sponsor, and they all said no. And this one lady, was that 10 minutes? Thank you. This one lady, God bless her, I asked her 3 times, and she's like, you're basically stalking me. And she referred me to somebody who just started sponsoring who had never sponsored before, and what a miracle, because she was exactly what I needed at the time. And so I just was to that point of, I'll do whatever you say, and I will do it naked and singing, and, like, I just am desperate, that gift of desperation. I just, for me, I had to be really beaten down to get desperate. I'd always, as I said, I'm always the good student, but if my heart's not in it, if I don't fully believe that I'm going to die, if I don't work these steps and follow direction, then I'm not going to fully recover. And the gift of that relapse has just been tremendous. I hope nobody has to go through that kind of a thing, because it really sucked. But it gave me that preciousness that abstinence is, well, I'm kind of on the fence. I've always said abstinence is the most important thing without exception, but I know today that I always say that because if I'm not abstinent, I'm blocking my higher power's will for me. I'm blocking that connection. But ultimately, if I'm trusting and relying upon my higher power, I'm not going to want to eat anyway. So, take your pick. But I know that if I'm not abstinent, all is lost for me. I'm definitely screwed. So it gave me that preciousness, that absolute respect for my recovery and for my abstinence. And there's a group of us that talk about sober eating, and for me, it's about this is what my food plan is. And first of all, let me back up a little. My abstinence is I eat 3 meals a day and 3 snacks, nothing in between, and that is doctor directed because I'm hypoglycemic. Actually, the doctor would like me to eat 8 times a day, and I said you could shove it up your ass. And then there is my food plan, which is started out as a commercial food plan, and then it went into just calorie counts. And I've worked with my sponsor to find what worked for me, and it had to change over the years. And then I have my alcoholic foods, and the top two of those, as I've mentioned, is refined sugar, you know, candies, cakes, cookies, ice cream, and refined sugar, period. And then white and wheat flour, and then anything else. There's other things like popcorn and other things that I'm not going to go into. They're not on my abstinence because when I was going down in my relapse, I put 30 foods on my abstinence thinking that if I laminated my card with my foods on them, that I would stay abstinent because I would just be safe because my ego didn't want to break my abstinence. And my ego said, well, screw that. We're going to start with the bottom thing, and we're going to just work our way up. And I did. I ate everything on that damn list. So the difference for me today is all those three things have the equal importance for me. I know that a lot of people talk about perfect abstinence, imperfect food plan. But if I'm screwing with my food, for me, that's where the sobriety of food comes in, then I am going to break my abstinence very quickly because I can't afford to let my will come in and think that I can decide what to put in my mouth because forget it, it's over. And so is that 5? Do I have 5 left? Okay, great, thank you. So that has given me the peace and freedom today with food to where I don't have 99% of it. And I'm not saying this to brag. I am saying this because this is an effing miracle that I don't have the chatter with food. I don't eat something and go, God, I want 10 more of those. And those foods are eliminated because they're given to my higher power. I have that peace and freedom where I am surrounded by people that are normies, and they eat and they love food, and that's not my food. And I don't sit there and longingly look at the case at the Starbucks, at the pastries, and go, God, I remember the day when I could just have all of that. Like, to me, that's hell on earth. When I'm having all that, I'm in so much pain and agony that it's not worth it for me today. And I really want to get across that is not me doing that because Lord knows I have tried to do that myself. And I do want to make sure and talk about what's happening today because a lot has happened in 11 years. I've walked through chronic illness. I've walked through being diagnosed with a form of congestive heart failure, not being able to work. I did it all in recovery, and it wasn't an option for me to eat. I no longer believe that food's going to solve my problems, and I got somewhere along the line that when I eat compulsively, I'm abusing myself, and I'm completely disregarding every bit of self-respect and potential love that I have for myself because I'm just gorging on food. That's just not an option today, and I remember calling somebody in my relapse, she has like 30-something years, and I told her, how do you not eat no matter what? I heard that, thank you. And she goes, I just, it's not an option. And I was like, F you, lady. Like, what in the hell? I told her that many times. I didn't tell her that, but I hung up the phone like, thank you very much. But it's just not an option today. But then there's life. There's those lovely character defects. Oh, my God. And God has been very gentle with me because I've led during this time a very isolated life, and slowly my life gets bigger, my life gets fuller, and having not worked and been able to work for a lot of years, I've now slowly ramped up from having my own clients to now I have pretty much a full-time job and still some of my old clients, and I'm able to be out in the world, but now there's character defects that are like, oh, I thought I was so, like, done with control. No. Oh, my God. I'm a manager at work, and I think it's my way or else, and that doesn't work with a family and friends-run business. So just learning to, like, Kazoon type, by the way, that I am not the end-all and the be-all, and then having health issues that I've been dealing with my mom. I'm an only child. There's no other family, and that feeling of, if my mom doesn't get her act together, I'm it to take care of her. Talk about control. And so I'm in another program now for that. But what it's done is it has made me feel a little separated from God, because I've been pissed off that I have these character defects. Like, why can't I just slap myself out of this and just be like, okay, be loving and kind, just be nice, just like, oh, I'm actually studying to be a practitioner in my church, like, what the hell is wrong with me? And the truth is this is stuff that I have not encountered in many years. And the truth is that when I've been in jobs in the past, I've had such issues with people that I've had to leave the jobs. I've never been fired because I'm just so good, but I've found a way to not work there. And now I'm willing to stay, and I'm willing to work it out, and I'm willing to get, like it says in step two, that I don't have the answers to everything, that if I don't know what's best for me, how do I know what's best for anybody else? And so I love the fact that this is a meeting about gratitude, and that this day is about gratitude, and hearing meetings this week about gratitude is very helpful, because it's been a time where I haven't felt as grateful, and I have so much to be grateful for. And I think it's just growing pains. I'm willing to be forgiving of myself and be like, it's okay, honey. You're working through this with your higher power's help, and your two sponsors. Now you have two sponsors. To just learn to let go and be amongst people and allow them to be themselves. And that's a miracle that I'm not eating over that. It's right there. Because I do have that perfectionistic, like, I should be walking on spiritual water by now and be, like, namasteing all the time and be, like, in a perpetual yoga, like, mindfulness stance. And it's not always like that. And yet my higher power still continues to guide me, still continues to shower me with goodness and love, still continues to have me show up and be of service, not only in this program, but within my church. And I consider myself selfish and self-centered to the extreme. I'm not your typical Al-Anon. Because I'm the addict, first and foremost. I am the addict, and I'm being people-pleasing and people-catering because ultimately I want to feel good. So there's a lot to work on, and I don't plan on leaving anytime soon, because I know that when I look at my part, when I follow direction, when I am willing to be in acceptance of where I'm at today and yet get on my knees, which is not my favorite thing to do, and be like, third step prayer, seventh step prayer, I really need your help, higher power, here, because I just can't let these go. I just cannot let go of the need to control, the need to manipulate, the need to have things go my way. Because there's a core belief that I will not be safe if things don't happen a certain way. It has lessened tremendously over time, but it's still there and it's still strong. So I know I'm running out of time, but all I can say is today, this day is not about food. And it's not about what I can get away with and what I can shove in my mouth. It's about honoring what I love to do. And what I love to do is, I actually really love OA, guys. I really do, because it saves my life daily. And I also want some alone time where I can just sit on my ass and watch television, which rarely happens. And I don't have to force myself to be, you guys can all have fun with other people, but for me, my fun with other people will be tomorrow with my mom. We're going to dinner, we're going to be civilized. And I'm taking my recovery there too. But for today, it's like, I want to be of service. I'll be of service later at another OA meeting. And then I get to be with myself and just recharge. And that's, for me, so I feel gratitude because I don't feel guilty about it, and I don't feel ashamed that I'm not doing it what everybody else is doing, and I feel like I'm learning to honor myself, and who knows, maybe next year I'll have a bunch of people at my house. God is full of surprises, we'll see, but I just thank you all for being here and for this day. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Erica. Woo! Our second speaker today is David.
Hi, I'm David. I'm a compulsive overeater. Can everyone hear me? Just tell me when it's over. Thank you, Arlene, for asking me, and Erica, that was awesome. Thank you. I have been in OA for 9 years, and this week I celebrated 7 years of abstinence. And my abstinence is no binging, no purging, no flour, no sugar. And I go to a meeting almost every day, and I go to a meeting because I need to know how to get better today. And people say Thanksgiving is just another day, and for me it's not just another day, because there are years of trauma and pain and alcoholism packed into this day that I'm carrying with me into this day. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how to get better today and what I'm doing today to get through the day, because that's what I need to hear, and that's why I go to meetings today, because 7 years of abstinence and the food doesn't call to me anymore, but I still don't want to show up for my life. And I learned that the food was never the problem. The food is just a symptom. The problem is I don't know how to deal with my life without food. And I have to look a little bit about, you know, what it used to be like so I can see what I'm up against today. And most of you know my story, which is so amazing being here. This is like one big happy family, and a lot of you know me, but I grew up on Long Island in a town called Cold Spring Harbor, and everything was perfect on the outside. My dad's a doctor, my mom's a psychologist, and everything always looked perfect, but especially on holidays, there was alcoholism, there was abuse, there were affairs, and there was just chaos. I remember just the earliest I could remember, my mom passing out at Thanksgiving dinners and Christmas dinners, and just feeling the shame of living with two alcoholics and carrying my mom off to bed and tucking her in and not knowing if she's going to wake up in the morning, and just that horror. And on the flip side of living with a pass-out drunk was living with an abuser, my dad. That trauma of him chasing my sister and I through the house and hurting us and beating us, and from such a young age, the food was the escape. The food was like, how am I getting, you know, the food was what I used to get through all of this. Like, I didn't have a happy childhood. I didn't have a, let's all sit down for Thanksgiving dinner and talk about our feelings and our problems, and I'll pass the talking stick and you go next. It was like, it was fight or flight, chaos, abuse, like, counting other people's glasses of wine and, you know, not knowing what's going to happen at the end of this meal, and just living in horror and shame and terror. And I have always used food to deal with life. I've always used food to deal with anxiety and fear and trauma and all of these things. Food was my best friend. Food was my higher power. Food was, as soon as I felt a big feeling, I went to the food. As soon as I felt like I didn't want to live in my skin, or I didn't want to live with my life, or I didn't want to live with my parents or my family, I just went to the food. And the food just quieted my mind. And the food made it all okay. And in the early days, the food made it okay for long periods of time. Like, the food didn't work against me until I crossed that invisible line. But in the beginning of my eating disorder, when I was 7 or 8 or 9, 10 years old, I could go hours with the food with a quiet mind. And my binges were my escapes, and they really saved my life. But now I'm packing on the weight. I'm 60 pounds overweight as a kid. I'm the fat kid in school. I'm getting picked on. And you know, growing up in abuse and alcoholism, I didn't have, like, the normal social development years of, like, learning how to make friends on the playground or learning how to raise my hand in the classroom or learning how to look people in the eye or learning how to make connections with other people. Like, from a really young age, I was dwarfed. I walked around with my head down. I didn't raise my hand in the classroom. I couldn't make friends on the playground. I couldn't look people in the eye. Like, I just didn't know how to deal with living in the world. So I would go home and just eat over it. And the food and me were best friends, and we were, like, secret friends. And I would go to the food, and then I'd show up at school and not know how to deal with school or people or my family, and then I'd just come home and eat over it. And the food really allowed me to deal with everything. And then I found bulimia. And I always say, the food took me out of life, but the bulimia took me off the planet. I found bulimia when I was 14 or 15 years old. My sister also suffers from an eating disorder. And I used to hear her throwing up via connecting rooms. And I would hear her throwing up every night. And she lost a ton of weight. And I went into her room one day, and I found her Slim Fast diet pills. And I was a sophomore in high school, and they say this is a progressive illness. By the time I was a junior, when I was a sophomore in high school, I was 60 pounds overweight. By the time I was a junior in high school, I was 30 pounds underweight. So that's a 90-pound swing. And I was now a three-sport athlete. I was taking 15 pills of hydroxycut every day. I was purging every day. I was counting my calories. I was obsessed with numbers. I was obsessed with getting rid of it. I was obsessed with throwing up in bathrooms where I had privacy. Like, my mind just went from all I have to do is get food to all I have to do is get rid of it and keep it off. And are you okay? And that just continued and continued and continued. And the more that my bulimia took over my life and the exercise addiction and the throwing up and the calories counting, the more I just became more and more and more removed from society. So now I'm going in and out of hospitals. I'm taking 3-quarter bottles of NyQuil every night just so that I can sleep. I'm failing out of my college. I haven't spoken to my dad in 15 years. I've never been in a relationship. And, like, every part of my life is just completely unmanageable until I came into OA 9 years ago. And OA, for me, yes, it's allowed me to have freedom from food obsession and exercise obsession and body obsession, but food for me has allowed me to show up for a life that I never thought I was worthy of living and have people in my life and really open up to. I didn't live life until I was 21 years old when I came into OA. Like, I didn't even know what life was. Life for me was binging and purging and overeating and calorie counting and starving. And it was really hard in the beginning. My first 2 years in program, I wasn't abstinent. I couldn't get it. It felt like everybody else had it. And I'm coming in with years of trauma and years of unworthiness and years of everybody else deserves it but me. So I'm just keep coming back. And I'm showing up and I'm going to meetings and it's not working. But I'm starting to connect with other people. And the beauty of keep coming back, 9 years in, there are people here today who have known me since day one. Like, I remember Thanksgiving 9 years ago, I was freaking out about going back to New York and spending the holidays with my family. And Abby, who's here somewhere, spent 45 minutes after a meeting at those early sunset, the sunset meeting, she spent 45 minutes just talking to me and walking me through what it was going to be like with my family. And I still went home, and I still binged through Thanksgiving, but, like, it was a little bit better. It was a little bit better because I was in OA, and I started to get the knowledge. And 2 years into program, I got abstinent, and I had 4 days of abstinence, and it just hit me, like, I don't have to spend the holidays with my family if I don't want to. My life started becoming important to me, and I made that decision 7 years ago, and I haven't spent I haven't spent Thanksgiving or Christmas with my family since, and it's been the greatest gift, because I learned, like, if I don't put up a boundary, you know, I heard early on in my recovery, a boundary is a third dimensional principle that allows me to live in the fourth dimension. If I don't put up a boundary, everybody else is walking over me, and then I eat over it. If I'm just flying back to New York and doing what everybody else wants me to do, I will eat over it, 100%. So I put up a boundary and I say, my life is important to me. I'm not going to show up for Thanksgiving, but I'm going to show up in another way. I'll show up in January or I'll show up in February when I'm not having all of this charge around the holidays. So my life starts becoming important to me and I keep coming back and I work the steps and I still work the steps. And in those early years of Thanksgiving, I did Friendsgiving. Because now I'm making connections with other people, and now I'm making real partnerships, because it says in the Big Book, we have the total inability to form true partnerships with other people. In OA, I start learning how to connect. I start leading with my heart. I start accessing my heart. I was in so much pain. My heart was so, like, frozen over when I came into OA. Now it's getting chipped away. And now I'm sharing in meetings, and now I'm starting to open up to people. And people are starting to see me and still, like, accept me. So now I'm having Friendsgivings with other people. And I'm going to Thanksgiving in the park, and I'm putting my program first, and I'm making my abstinence the most important thing without exception. And now 7 years into OA, 7 years into abstinence, my abstinence is still the most important thing in my life without exception. And I go to a meeting every day, and I work the program, and what am I doing today? Because they say, you know, today is just like any other day. But when I remember Thanksgiving, I remember my mom passing out, my dad hurting us, having to lie at school the next Monday about what Thanksgiving was really like, and just the trauma and the chaos. So what do I do today? I wake up, I get on my knees, and I say, God, can you protect me from my mind? Can you help me have a new experience and a new thought life about what I think Thanksgiving is going to go like today? Because if it were up to me, I would just spend Thanksgiving alone. I would just do fantasy football on my couch, like, with all day, and just isolate from people, and just, because it's so hard for me. At the core, and the core, and the core of my disease, I'm just so scared of people. I'm just so scared of showing up for my life. I'm just so scared of social interactions and conversations and, like, family dinners and how are you doing today. I just don't know how. My mind tells me I don't know how to do it, so it keeps me away. And it keeps me away from intimacy, and it keeps me away from connection, and it keeps me away from showing up. My mind just tells me I don't know how to show up for a Thanksgiving dinner. I don't know how to have conversations with people. I don't know how to, like, small talk. And when I get into these situations, if I don't have a higher power with me, if I'm not connected, my mind's just talking to me while I'm talking to other people. And it's telling me, why did you say that? Why are you talking to this person? Why don't you ask them this thing? And my mind just takes me out of life, and it just takes me away from the present moment, and it just talks to me and talks to me. And I need some fucking peace and quiet from my mind, so I go to the food. And I go to the food on Thanksgiving because my mind won't stop talking to me, and I just need some peace and quiet. So I have to treat my mind first. And if I treat my mind, you know, like it says in the Big Book, I can show up anywhere. I can show up at a bar. I can show up at a feast. I can show up anywhere at a buffet, at an all-you-can-eat buffet. If my mind's treated, if I'm connected to a higher power, I can go anywhere. But for me, coming from the trauma and the chaos that I come from, it takes me a lot to treat my mind. It takes a lot of work. So I get on my knees first thing in the morning. I pray. I go to a meeting. I make a lot of outreach calls because that gets me out of my mind. And, you know, they say Thanksgiving's about gratitude. So I call people and I express my gratitude. My first sponsor, when I came into OA 9 years ago, she's no longer in program. She doesn't live in California anymore, but I call her every Thanksgiving, and I spoke to her this morning, and I said, thank you for my life, because I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have abstinence if you didn't take a bus every week for a year straight from Compton to Culver City, meeting with me while I worked through the steps. And that's what we learn how to do here. We go the extra mile, we be of service, and we give back what was freely given to us. Great abstinence for me is an undeserved gift. I don't know why I got it. I don't know why I have freedom from food obsession today. But I do know I won't keep it unless I give it away. So I find people who I can give it away to, and I find people who I can express my gratitude with. And I don't go to the butcher shop for milk anymore. I don't go to my family on the holidays. I can send a text. I can make a phone call. But I'm not going to get into that whole war zone dynamic anymore because my life is important to me. And I learned today, I came into OA when I was 21 years old. I'm 30 now. Most of my triggers and dysfunction and how I show up is all rooted in my childhood. And if I don't go back there and heal that and do the work around that, I'm going to show up today just how I was programmed. Like, I have to go back and do the work. And for me, doing the work is not going back and not showing up for them and not overeating and putting my life first and putting up a boundary and finding ways today to be of service throughout the day. Because this is a charged day, and there is lots of food, and food starts early, but that doesn't mean I have to get in the ring, because I have to do something different if my life is important to me. I find certain ways to be of service wherever I go. So if I'm at a family dinner, you know, with my chosen family, and there's food all around, I go do the dishes. I get out. I find ways to connect with God. I find someone who's all alone, and I start having the conversation with them. I say, how can I be of service to you? And that's like my motto for my life. How can I be of service to you? What can I do to make things easier? What can I do to make things better? And I don't do that because I want to be a good person. I do that because I want to keep my abstinence and save my life. Like, I need to be of service every single day in order to stay abstinent. I'm not, like, a spiritual anything. I don't want to, like, be here. I just need to do it to save my life, and I know what I need to do today. I need to find ways to be of service throughout the day. I wrote a gratitude list this morning of 20 things I'm grateful for, and I know today that I can act my way into right gratitude. If I just write a gratitude list of 20 things that I'm grateful for and actually feel the gratitude that I have, I start to be more grateful in the day. And I actually, like, have things today to be grateful for. This program for me has given me a psychic change. The way that I look at life and show up for my life is completely different. I'm no longer a taker. Thanksgiving for me used to be like, where's the food? What am I going to get out of this? Like, I'm only showing up, you know, what am I going to get? Like, where's the food? Where's the bathroom? Let me take the diet pills, and I have to leave because I have to go to the gym after to work this off. Today, Thanksgiving for me is about gratitude and service and showing up for my life and having freedom and being grateful for the freedom that I've been given. I'm so grateful for the life and the family that OA has given me. This program for me has given me everything good that is in my life today. And, you know, I did some research before the meeting. And if you're the seventh tradition, or if you're a tradition police, this is conference approved. But I looked for, like, gratitude quotes from the Big Book. And there aren't many. But Bill Wilson, you know, the founder of AA, posted this thing 60 years ago. And it says, Thanksgiving is gratitude in action. We not only feel grateful, we say so with the joy of prisoners set free. We thank God for his light whereby we now see, and for the gift of his grace by which we breathe and live in a wondrous new world. Gratitude should go forward rather than backwards. In other words, if you carry the message to still others, you will be making the best possible repayment for the help given to you. When I came into OA, I hadn't spoken to my dad in 15 years, and I testified against my dad when I was 7 years old, and the court took away custody, and I went through a long period of having a lot of hatred in my heart for my dad, and through the course of working the steps and making amends, I saw my dad again, and we now have this new relationship, and about 2 months ago, I flew back to New York. My sister got married, and my dad, you know, we've seen each other maybe 3 times in the last 15 years, and he was at this wedding, and he said, can I talk to you for a few minutes before they actually get married? And I said, okay. So he takes me out to the balcony, And he made amends for everything that he has ever done wrong, basically. And he said, with, you know, my dad was severely abusive and there were cops always at our house. And it was really bad. And he said, with the abuse, like, it would just take over me and I wouldn't know what happened the next day. Like, I wouldn't know that I did those things. And it hit me in that moment that for me, with my eating disorder, it was the same thing with him with the abuse. The food would take over me. I didn't know what happened. I didn't, you know, it would just, a power greater than myself would just overtake me. And he said, what would you like to do now? Do you want to never talk again? Do you want to never, you know, see each other again? And what came out of me in the moment was, I give you my forgiveness. And that's not like how I talk. That's not a sentence that I would normally say. That's like a Yoda sentence. But I said, I give you my forgiveness. And I didn't even know why I said it for like the next couple of days. But then it hit me that abstinence for me was given. Like, I didn't earn it. I did do the work to get it. But it just came to me. It was an undeserved gift. And if I can get that gift, then I can give gifts like forgiveness. He doesn't earn that. He didn't deserve it, but I can give it away. And that's how this program works for me. I think that's my time. Thank you for letting me share.
Well, David is up here. Thank you so much. And we're going to wish him a happy 7th birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear David. Happy
birthday to you. Woo! Yes. Okay. We will now observe the 7th tradition, which states that we are fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And then following the 7th tradition, we'll have our final speaker. So, Alexis, would you read the 12 traditions, please? And then we'll have some OA-related announcements.
Okay, where is it? Where is it? Oh, that's it. Okay. Let's compose the readers. The 12 traditions of Overeaters Anonymous. 1. Our common welfare comes first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. 3. The only requirement for OA membership is the desire to stop eating compulsively. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. 5. Each group has one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. 6. An OA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and proceeds divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. OA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, film, television, and other public media of communication. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality.
So, just a couple of announcements. First of all, does anyone need a ride? Yay. What? Somebody need a ride? When? Burton Way and Elm, Beverly Hills. Nice. Anybody else? Okay. The Promises meeting is next Saturday night, a week from Saturday. I think it's December 2nd from 7 to 9, and it's going to be at St. Bede's Church. You can see it on the 12-stepper, which we have 12-steppers over there. We'll have 12 speakers, each sharing their experience of promises coming true in their lives. It'll be a candlelight meeting and a night to always remember. It's wonderful. Please join us for that event, 7 to 9 Saturday evening. And I need people to be of service. Please, please. People to greet, to time, to set up, to collect, to clean up, the whole deal. And thank you so much. Please do that. And Susan, do you want to announce the birthday party before? Susan is our final speaker, and she's our birthday chair. And yes.
Hi, how are you? Wait. It wasn't me.
It was me. Okay.
Okay. OA birthday party, Sunlight of the Spirit. If you want one of these t-shirts, Jana is holding them up. We have all sizes, two colors, $20. We're up to 439 registrations because we sent you all an email yesterday reminding you that on Black Friday, what's going to happen? Registration is going to go up $10. Two lattes you're going to lose out on if you don't register. Maybe it won't go up until midday on Black Friday. We're not quite sure. That's going to be decided. So you might want to sign up tonight. We have panels, workshops, big book workshop, amazing speakers, some of them who are here today. People coming from all over the world. So we have a comedy show, a very professional comedy show. Rashad is going to be our DJ, and clearly you can see he knows how to work the mic better than us. So if you have any questions, if you want to volunteer, please come and see me afterwards, and I really hope that you all will come, as it's a great boost to your recovery. Thank you.
And our final speaker today is Susan. Yay. Now listen, you can sign up right now, today, for the birthday party while it's on your mind so that you don't throw your money down the toilet for $10 extra. Okay, here comes Susan.
Hi, I'm Susan Compost-Soderista. First of all, thank you, Arlene, so much for asking me to be here. Thank you to the LA Institute for putting this together. All the new friends in the future of LA are outside of the world. It takes a lot to put this together, so I'm very, very grateful to everybody who's been on this project and has been doing it. And it's always a very humbling moment when I'm asked to share my story. My photos are going around. Thank you for being so important, because I always assume that everybody's seen them, but there's a lot of people here who probably haven't seen them. Thank you. 15 and 5. Thank you so much. Erica and David have really summed up everything. So I have my story. I identify with everything that they say, even though we come from different families, different places, and that's why we come to meetings, to identify, to get to hear how I don't eat no matter what, which is such a weird thing always to say, because obviously I do eat. But I don't eat those foods that drive me crazy, that set up that phenomenon of craving, that starve that allergy. Because if I do that, I can't spiritually awaken. I can't have that spiritual experience that's talked about in Appendix 2. So to get the numbers and to qualify out the way, I have 18 and a half years. My top weight I know was 250 pounds. I was 26 dress. I am down 120 pounds. I no longer wear a size 9 shoe. My shoes are back down to a size 7. There's all these little weird things that happen to your body. And all of this is very, very humbling, because none of it is about me. It's about the community of OA. It's about working these 12 steps and sticking with a God of my understanding and not being told how I have to eat, what I have to do. Just as somebody who's gone ahead of me and has recovered a day at a time of what's worked for them. And I've had 4 sponsors in this program. Each of them has been different. One's been a bulimic, actually two have been bulimics. One was maybe 20 pounds. overweight, one was 100 pounder, but what they've all done is they've always taken me back to the Golden Steps and what they have done, what their experience has been. So I came to my first meeting when I moved here and I was 21. I don't remember very much about it. It was in the OA office, which was on Reseda at the time in the Valley. And I was 250 pounds. I remember there were no seats left and I had to kind of hike myself up on this high thing and it was terribly embarrassing, so I just decided I hated it. I didn't like it. It felt very strange to me. You don't talk about outside matters out of your house. My real mom is schizophrenic. We left everything in our house. You shut the door. We all look good, but you don't discuss what goes on inside. So it was very odd to me. And you Americans talk a lot about your feelings. I've lived here for a long time now, but even sometimes I'm still like, what's happening? Oh, my God. But that's okay. That's how I've recovered today, is by not keeping any secrets. Never used to tell people about my mom. When my parents got divorced, it was mortifying. Nobody I knew was divorced, just didn't talk about it. So, you know, I have all these things that make up my story that I can make you feel really, really sorry for me, and I can live on that, which I did for many, many years. But the bottom line is, every time I had a feeling, I ate over it and I blamed somebody else. So today I have the gift of not doing that. And how have I done that? Taken very clear-cut directions that I don't always like to hear, that I haven't always wanted to do. I've sat through a lot of discomfort, and I put pen to paper, I put the fork down, and I have written. I don't type my step work, I write it, and there is just such a different emotion. I've worked those steps over and over again. I've done inventories in different formats. I've done every single book. I've just done it all, and, you know, I have... Roberta told me about another book a couple of weeks ago that I bought, and it's like, okay, I don't know everything. I didn't know about that book. So I came here, I went to that meeting, I've done really all the same crazy diet things as David and Erica, except I don't think either of them wired their mouth shut, so yay me, I did that, but yay me, I lost no weight on it because you can drink milkshakes, and I found a hole in the back, and I just popped chocolates in there, so that wasn't very good, that experiment didn't work, and I'm one of these people who's a really, really good dieter, because I love to win, I love to be at the front of the class, so I like to get your badges, your ribbons, your gifts, whatever they're offering, and I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and nobody ever told me that I had a disease of my mind, or there was a mind and a body connection of why I couldn't stop eating. Why I couldn't eat a slice, why I had to eat a loaf, and when that loaf was gone, well, what's wrong with having another one? People who just need to lose a few pounds don't do that. Their mind isn't triggered in the same way. They don't have that physical allergy that I have. So I continue to do all of these things. My life here has always been good. I always say I was brought here to find OA. I wouldn't have found it at home. And because we live in LA, I kept on meeting people who were in 12-step programs, and it was a little bit annoying. Everybody was either in AA or OA, and I just, very cultish, not for me. And I just couldn't stop, and I love to exercise a ton when I eat a lot. Today, if I wouldn't be standing here, I'd been 2 or 3 spin classes back to back, and I would have been last night, I would have been there this morning, and I probably wouldn't have eaten for a couple of days. Today, it's such a gift. I've had my normal breakfast. I will have three meals that work for me. And just for me, my absence is no flour, no sugar. So that's no matter what. When I put my head down on the pillow at night, there's no question. I've been sober with my food. And always today, I can be sober with my food. But how am I behaving in light of my sobriety with my food? And the only way I can behave appropriately is by continuing to work these steps. Because it says, as a result of these steps, as the result of working these steps. Hello, that's Moses. my sidekick. So I kept coming in and out. I would go to different meetings all over the place. I never wanted to get friendly with anyone. You were always all so nice to me, so welcoming. People always took my phone numbers. They called me. I never called you back. And my life just kept on going. I had a good job. I was able to purchase a home. Everything looked good. I was one of those people who always dressed, did their makeup. I got up, I showed up. My disease didn't take me out in that way. But it took me into a very dark place in my head. When you were smiling at me, the things I was thinking about you weren't very precious. So I kept coming in and out, and I would try going to therapy, and I really, really hated it. It was very, very uncomfortable, and every therapy session I would leave, I would go out and binge as if I was hurting men. And then I found a therapist through a friend of mine who I worked with who was in AA, and he was very, very 12-step based. And the funny part is he was very, very overweight, and so was I at the time. And I told him my whole sob story about my family and this and this and this, and when I'm thin and when I'm thin and when I'm thin, because that was always the beginning of every sentence. I always apologize for breathing, and when I'm thin, this will happen. And he basically wasn't interested in hearing my story after the first time he'd heard it. He, you know, I'm sure thought that was sad or how, whatever he thought, I don't know. And he asked me about me and how I wanted to live my life today. And I didn't quite understand what he was asking me, because it would just depend on when I got out of bed and how I was feeling and what would happen. And he started to talk to me about living in the moment and being in the present, and whether I'm fat, thin, or the bulimic, anorexic, how am I going to live these 24 hours? And that was always what he talked to me about. And so suddenly I started to realize that I have to start looking inside, and the words that I heard all of you speaking at meetings started to make sense to me, because people would say it's an inside job, and if you just work the steps, and you'll have a psychic change, and it's a spiritual awakening. And as I would sit there and talk to Sam, or he would talk, I sat there with my arms folded, it started to lessen. I was still 250 pounds, but suddenly it was like, okay, maybe I don't have to wait to do that. Maybe I don't have to wait to do this. I can just show up. And so I carried on doing things. My disease takes me to the point that I'm always very social, but it's an overabundance of being social. So if you're having a shower, my gift is wrapped the biggest. It has the biggest surge. You're coming to my house for dinner, there's five main dishes instead of just one. It's always just over the top. And today I have this ease and this flow that I don't have to do that. You know, one is enough. You just need one main course and a few sides. So the day finally came when I was taken to that place of willingness, and I had gone home, funny thing, for a family trip. And, you know, I live out here on my own, but wherever you go, there you are. My dad lives here now, which is great. And I went home for my sister's wedding, and it was horrible. And I hadn't wanted to go, and she and I had been estranged for a while. And I went to her wedding. I mainly did it because my dad asked me, and he's my parents and my thing, and we have our issues, but I show up. And I went, and it was the last time I ate sugar there. I ate practically her whole wedding cake, which are these things called profiteroles, and it was in this big triangle like a pyramid. And I just sat and started eating them from the back. There was just so much angst and so many different things going on. I'm the oldest of seven children, so there isn't one day of the week that one of us doesn't own that's horrible. And my sister wasn't happy I was there, and the next day we had this awful argument. And I remember I went in jeans, I was down a little bit at the time, and I couldn't get them back on to get on the plane. They were about this far apart. And I started to scream at my dad that he had clearly cooked with far too much salt. And we always laugh about this now. Whenever we're seasoning something, he'll go steady on there with the salt. Because today, thank God, I can laugh at myself, and I do a lot, because I do some silly things that need to be laughed at. I have to laugh, you know, I have to laugh in the recovery. So I came back, and a cousin of mine who lived in Florida at the time, she had gotten into program and come down for nearly 300 pounds. And I didn't really want what she had, but I wanted to know what she was doing so that I could follow it. And I told her I wanted to work with her sponsor. And she said, that's a bit silly. She's there in Florida. You have, you know, all those people out there. And I said, yeah, no one's available. The one thing about talking last is... Anyway, so I called this woman. I stalked her for 4 days. And she finally called me back. Her name is Bonnie, and she saved my life. I spoke to her on a Sunday for 2 hours, and she agreed to sponsor me because I really just talked her into the wall. And then the moment came, and I stood at the turning point, and she said to me, what are you going to have for dinner? And just this, oh, you know that moment when you're like, what am I going to have for dinner? It's Sunday night. You want me to stop eating? I'm certainly not going to share with you what I'm going to have for dinner, but it's clearly not going to look like something you're thinking about. So I said, well, I'd like to start in the morning. And this is where she saved my life. She said to me, Susan, we've been on the phone for 2 hours, and you're crying, and you're desperate, and you're willing to call me. I'm good. At 4:45 a.m. in the morning, 5 days a week, but you're not willing to tell me what you're going to have for dinner tonight. She said, if you don't tell me what you're going to have for dinner tonight, that's okay, but I know I won't hear from you tomorrow. And I started to spiritually awaken. I was like, okay. She said, for her, she was very clear. She was 100-pounder, weigh and measure the food, whatever. That works for me. It doesn't have to work for you. And she asked me if I had a scale, and of course, I had to ask her what brand, because I had several. But you know what? She saved my life, and she was so right, and I'm so grateful for all my sponsors who have been very, very black and white. They haven't coddled me to death. It's like, this is it. This is the situation. This is it. Do you want this or don't you? This is a program of action. And from Sunday night to Monday morning, I get lost in the abyss. From the minute I would get into bed and I'd have all this great plan, I just put my feet on the ground. It was already done. It was done. So that was the first night that I had an abstinent meal. That was the first time I hadn't lied about my food to anyone other than maybe if I paid you for a while, because there was always some kind of reward at the end of that. And from then on, she sponsored me, I think, for 4 or 5 years. It was just 4, but I remember I flew down there once to do a 4-step. I flew her out here. And it was really kind of amazing, everything that's happened between then and now. I'm fortunate my body responds well to eating absolutely. I was able to get my weight off. It's definitely a little weird when you stay there for a while. Kind of used to walk backwards through mirrors or ask for the wrong sizes in stores, or they'd then say to me, are you buying a gift? They used to ask me if I was buying a gift when I was size 26 and looking to buy smaller clothes to get into, because they used to save them. So it's like that, are you buying a gift? It never goes away. So I kept on coming and I kept on coming, and suddenly you all look prettier, you're all so much nicer. I wanted you to phone me, and when you phoned me, I phoned you back, and I kept on working the steps. I kept on being willing. I had to be turned towards that sunlight of the spirit. And, you know, it says, great events will come to pass for you and countless others, and I really include myself in that. One thing Bonnie told me is, come isolate. You have to be in the center of the herd. The animals who run on the outside don't always survive. I'm a really slow runner, so I'm glad to be in the middle with you that you pushed me through. And those things are true, you know, as I think David commented, you know, people come and go, we see them come and go, and some people come back or some people leave the room. So I, from my experience, staying right in the center and asking other people for help or calling you about something I might have heard you say in a meeting is how I get there. That's how I spiritually grow. So now, you know, time has moved on a lot, and I definitely, you know, certain things come to all of us in different ways. For me, being of service isn't an issue. There's certain things I do in my outside life and incorporate. I've gotten to chair the birthday party for the 2nd year in a row, which is very humbling. It really teaches me to, you know, I'm not the boss of everyone. If only they would all listen to me, but they don't. And you know what? Guess what? Other people have better ideas than me sometimes. Other people have good ideas, and I can learn from that. I don't have to be that fat girl who's so scared to let you in and don't come near me and only my way will work, because if I do it this way, I may have to eat this. Today, that doesn't come into it. Today, my food somehow isn't a part of any of it. I still commit my food in the morning. I send it to my sponsor. If I don't know what I'm going to have, it'll be TBA, to be determined, to be announced, however it is. But no matter what, I'm going to be absent. When I put my head on the pillow tonight, not only am I going to have been sober with my food, I really hope and pray I've caused no wreckage along the way. And sometimes I do. And I really try hard not to go to bed having caused any. I'm not perfect, but I make amends where I can. And sometimes I'm not always aware of something that I've done. And that's the great thing about being in the center of the herd. Somebody will give me the elbow and go, probably not the best way. 10 more? 5 more. Oh, good. So, you know, yes, Thanksgiving is another day, and yet it isn't. Obviously, I didn't grow up with this, but there's many holidays in the world that are. And the fact, again, that I want to be here and not spinning 3 classes, and we're having, if anybody's coming towards, you know, going over the canyon at the OA office in Woodland Hills, there's been a marathon going there every hour from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. I'll be there at 2 p.m. with my Sunday morning crowd, whoever's coming. And I get to do this. That's the thing. I don't have to do this. I knew 250 pounds wasn't a very good idea, but don't tell me when I'm going to start losing my weight. But here, this is such a gift. It's a gift that does keep on giving. I don't have to stop doing this, nor do I want to a day at a time, but I know it's contingent. It's contingent on me getting out of bed, and before I get out of bed, saying a set-aside prayer. Whether that set-aside prayer includes something that's going to go on at work,
in my regular life, but setting aside everything I think I know about myself, the 12 steps, and God. And that's how I have to do that. And then my food, I take my lunches to work. For me, food prep is a big thing that I do. It's just something I enjoy cooking. I enjoy doing it. I sponsor a lot of women in this program, and that's a gift. It isn't because I have to, but I enjoy it, and I get so much from all of them, and it's such a humbling place to be in. And guess what? They read the book and see something that I haven't seen. It's like, wow. I talk to my sponsor. We have our once-a-week call time. She lives near me, so sometimes I see her, or we speak a lot. I've already sent her my stuff for this morning, sent her a happy Thanksgiving, get to drive with sponsees today, which is so nice. And if you are struggling, you had the willingness to come here this morning, reach out to others today. I'm going to have my phone on all day. I'm going to be at the meeting tonight with Erica as well. And because, again, I get to do this. And I still get to eat and have fun. But I just, it is, this is no matter what. This is the most important thing in my life, because if it isn't, I can't care about you or give out love in the way that I want to. So I'm eternally grateful to Roseanne, to Bill W., and to Dr. Bob, because what they created for me has given me a life truly beyond my wildest dreams. None of this is me. I can't do this alone, so I'm so glad that you all showed up. Arlene, thank you again for all the hard work that you did putting this together. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you.